You've been this first one for years and it's still relevant and close.
We're taught that after the war the Nazis vanished without a trace. But the Italians, the fascists, still dream of a master race. The history books, they tell of their defeat in 45. But they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died.
They say the prisoner of Spandau was a symbol of defeat. Whilst Hess remained in prison, then the fascists, they were beat. So the promise of an Aryan world would never materialise.
So why did they all come out of the woodwork
on the day the Nazi died? The world is riddled with maggots, the maggots are getting fat. They're making a tasty meal of all the bosses and bureaucrats. They're taking over the boardrooms and they're fat and full of pride. And they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died. So if you meet with these historians, I'll tell you what to say. Tell them that the Nazis never really went away. They're out there burning houses down and peddling racist lies. And we'll never rest again until every Nazi dies.
All right, welcome to Indie Media On Air. This is Chris Burnett. I'm joined in studio with Stephen Starr once again. How are you doing, Stephen?
I'm great. Good to be here.
That was Chumbawamba with The Day the Nazi Died. It was recorded in 1994 at a live show in Leeds. We have a special show for you today. We're going to be talking about the World Social Forum, if we're lucky. We're waiting for a contact down there, and we're hoping to get a call in. We're also going to be talking about GreaseNotGas.com, and we're going to be talking with Mark Parziel, who built his truck to run on vegetable oil. We will also have an update from
Downhill Battle is going to give us an update on their latest action. I know Chris had the folks from Downhill Battle on last week talking about their general purpose and what they do, and we have some pretty exciting stuff. They've just launched a great new initiative in honor of Black History Month, and we'll get to that in just a few minutes.
We're going to go to headline news from Indie Media, but first I want to announce the Independent Media Center, Los Angeles IMC, will be having a screening this Thursday at 7:30 p.m. at Rocco Titlan Cafe at 1277 Wilton Place. They'll be screening Out Fox, which is an examination of how media empires led by Rupert Murdoch's Fox News have been running a race to the bottom in television news. The film provides an in-depth look at Fox News and the dangers of an ever-enlarging corporations taking control of the public airwaves. So please join LA IMC this Thursday at 7:30 p.m. at Rocco Titlan Cafe at 1277 Wilton Place. It's at the corner of Wilton and Fountain in Hollywood. Also, I should mention that the next meeting for the LAIMC is this Saturday at noon at the same location. From indiemedia.org, farm workers from the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, the Florida group leading the Taco Bell boycott, and allies from across the U.S. are gearing up for the 2005 Taco Bell Truth Tour to draw attention to sweatshop conditions and forced labor in American agriculture. Between February 28th and March 5th, farm workers will tour the South, East, and Midwest to expose the truth of how Taco Bell and its parent company, Yum Brands, profit from farm workers' extreme poverty. Tour stops include Atlanta, Nashville, Cincinnati, Cleveland, St. Louis, Indianapolis, Chicago, among others. And from AustinIndieMedia.org, on January 24th, in Columbus, Georgia, five human rights advocates, including a chaplain, students, a steelworker, a farmer, and a 79-year-old retiree, were sentenced to 3 months in federal prison and fines of up to $500 for acts of nonviolent civil disobedience, calling for the closure of the U.S. Army's School of the Americas, SOA. Another defendant was sentenced to 1 year of probation with a $1,000 fine. Eight of their co-defendants, two of whom are high school students, will continue their trials tomorrow. It's a sad day when peace protesters go to prison and the perpetrators of human rights violations will never see the inside of a courthouse, let alone a jail, said Liz DeLigio, 28, a chaplain and student from Chicago, Illinois, sentenced to 3 months in prison. The defendants were among more than 16,000 who gathered at the gates of Fort Benning on November 20, 2004, to call for the closure of the controversial school. now renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. The group is charged with peacefully crossing onto the military base side of the SOA at the culmination of a symbolic funeral procession in memory of victims of graduates of the school. The 14 are on trial before Judge G. Mallon Faircloth, known for handing down stiff sentences to opponents of the SOA. Since protests against the institution began more than a decade ago, more than 170 people have served a total of over 75 years in prison for engaging in nonviolent resistance in a broad-based campaign to close the school. For more information, please visit soaw.org. That's soaw.org. From Indy Bay, Iraq's flawed election. Bombs and mortar attacks faced many Iraqis who went to the polls Sunday, January 30th, yesterday. Baghdad bore the brunt, and 13 people were killed in 8 suicide attacks launched in rapid succession at voter queues. The U.S. Embassy came under rocket fire, with several casualties reported. And a British military transport plane is alleged to have been shot down by a surface-to-air missile, killing up to 15 British troops. Voter turnout was high in the Kurdish north and the Shiite south, but turnout was much lower in the Sunni areas, with some reports that few, if any, Iraqis were able to vote in Samarra, a city of over 200,000 people. The Sistani-backed United Iraqi Alliance is expected to dominate the poll. For more information, please visit indybay.org. There's quite a few links there which are really good and give you some background on what happened yesterday. Okay, moving into our show, we have Tiffany. Welcome to KPFK.
Tiffany Chang, Downhill Battle. Are you with us?
I'm here. Thank you.
So great to have you on the air, and thank you so much for joining us today. So last week, our listeners got a pretty nice look at what Downhill Battle was up to. I know you guys started from the sort of Northern Massachusetts indie media movement, and you're really well known and actually much better known to our audiences now for the work you do around breaking up the music business monopoly. But you've also taken on some new initiatives, in particular one really, really exciting initiative in honor of Black History Month this month. And I think our listeners would be really excited to hear about it. Why don't you tell them what you guys are doing?
Sure. This Black History Month, we're helping to organize screenings across the country of Eyes on the Prize. Eyes on the Prize is the most important civil rights documentary on the civil rights movement that has ever been made. And it has been unavailable to the public for the past 10 years simply because of copyright restrictions and the way copyright industries tout around their copyrights. And because of their use of copyrights and their licenses, Eyes on the Prize has not been available, and we took it in our took it as our responsibility this year to help the public access this film and have screenings across the country. The screenings are supposed to happen February 8th at 8 p.m., but of course, if you can't have a screening on February 8th, please have it sometime during Black History Month. It's really, really important to start celebrating the civil rights movement by showing how much we care about this film. This film, it has been an important educational resource for many schools. I personally learned all about the civil rights movement by watching this film, and my vice principal said, if you're going to be smart, you're going to be political. And she sat me down and watched Eyes on the Prize every single day until I was done, and it has left an incredible impression on me, and everything I know about the civil rights movement is from this film, and we can't let corporate industries decide that Eyes on the Prize should not be available. So we need public support as much as we can.
So we'll get to the copyright issues in just a moment, but how do people get the film? I mean, by what means were you able to distribute the film enough to start engaging people to start doing these screenings around the country?
Well, last week when we launched the campaign, we urged people to find copies of Eyes on the Prize at their libraries, and also we provided a link to a digital version of Eyes on the Prize online, and they were torrent links that people were able to download. There were about 2,000 downloads last week, but now the torrent links are down, and the torrent links exist on the Internet. We do not link to them, but they do exist on the Internet. people are writing in. I've gotten tons of emails about how they can't get Eyes on the Prize and therefore can't have these screenings. And this is the problem. You know, Eyes on the Prize is so important, but now it's being stopped from being accessible to the public because of copyright. And that's the only reason why copyright matters in this case.
Is there any evidence that Eyes on the Prize can be found on, besides the BitTorrent links or trackers, are there any other peer-to-peer networks where Eyes on the Prize can be found now?
I've heard about the existence of Eyes on the Prize on the Internet. I think if you go to boingboing.net, there should be a link to the files on the Internet. I do not know specifically. But
I'm guessing you could do a Google search and hopefully find the links to them.
So if people were to be able to locate this on their own regard, the hope is that they will download it and perhaps burn it to DVD and hold screenings in their community to educate people about the civil rights movement?
Right. We really want to celebrate the civil rights, or the triumph of African Americans during the civil rights movement, and you can't do this without having a dialogue, without seeing what happened during the civil rights movement. And every time I watch a clip of Eyes on the Prize, I see so clearly why people need to see this. You honestly just have to see this documentary to understand what happened then. And people in elementary schools haven't heard about Eyes on the Prize for 10 years. And it's simply because schools and universities don't have access to Eyes on the Prize. And it's a simple problem that we can fix. And actually, just by having these screenings and by the public showing that they care about this film, it helps. It helps those people in negotiations to get EMI and to get all those other copyright licensees to make a deal, and make a deal that the production company can make and bring Eyes on the Prize back to the public.
What kind of material is copyrighted within the film that's preventing it from being released?
I'm not completely sure about that, because most of the negotiations and most of the records on this are still secret. The Ford Foundation has put up $65,000 just to research how much it would cost to clear all of the copyrighted works in Eyes on the Prize. And the total cost is about $500,000. An example of one of the works that had to be cleared in order for Eyes on the Prize to be released is the song Happy Birthday. Happy Birthday was sung to Martin Luther King Jr. During one scene where he was very upset, I guess, and his staff decided to sing Happy Birthday. The singing of Happy Birthday in of itself is copyrighted. If you sing it in a public place, if ASCAP and the copyright owners find out and want to charge you, they can charge you $10,000 for doing something like that. And so we're not even sure that documenting a group of people singing Happy Birthday is actually copyrightable, if they can actually charge you for copyright. But they have. And they have charged Eyes on the Prize for that, and they've paid $10,000.
Who owns a copyright to Happy Birthday?
The family of Black Side Productions, which is, or at one point was the largest African-American production company in America, owns the copyrights to this movie. They were the production company on Eyes on the Prize, and the founder and producer of Blackside has died and has left the rights to his sisters.
Right. I think Chris's question was, who owns the copyright to Happy Birthday? But there's some lyricist who wrote the song Happy Birthday and controls those rights. But let me ask a larger question. In this, what is the social implications of copyright? I know that there's a larger agenda that drove your thinking in terms of free culture and the ability of the commons to have access to educational materials such as a vital civil rights document. What is it? Could you sort of in shorthand give us a look at what that logic is?
Sure. We believe that copyright industries, like the major labels, like EMI, have been stifling creativity since they started. They hold these copyrights and have pushed laws through Congress that expand and extend the meaning of copyright to a point where copyright doesn't serve artists, and it doesn't serve musicians, and it doesn't serve documentarists, and it doesn't serve filmmakers anymore. It, in fact, hinders their work by making, by creating this labyrinthine process where they can't get out of. They have to find out who the copyright owners in this huge process, and it turns out that the research even costs more than they can afford. So copyright industries have been making it so, and for the past 40 years have been extending and expanding copyright so that they can continue to keep control of historical works so that they can continue to be paid. It's a system that works for them and doesn't work for the artists. And we argue that we need to bring these issues up again, and Eyes on the Prize is a perfect example of an extremely important work being hurt by copyright industries. And, you know, even documentaries that have historical and educational value are being hurt by copyright industries. And that's why we brought up Eyes on the Prize.
Right. And the larger argument that I've heard is that the social commons, the ability for the public sphere to be impacted by good art and good creativity is affected by these restrictive copyright efforts. And creativecommons.org is a great example of people who are trying to fight that downhill battle. Of course, Tiffany and her crew up there in Worcester is another example. Tiffany, tell people where to go to find out more on Eyes on the Screen, and then we're going to jump to our next interview.
Sure. You can organize and tell everybody about your screening at eyesonthescreen.org, and you can read more about it there.
Just a big thank you from all of us over here at KPFK. Tiffany Chang from Downhill Battle. Eyes on the Screen is the project. Eyesonthescreen.org is where you can find out more. If you want to have a screening, you folks in Los Angeles want to have a screening of this seminal document on the civil rights movement, go to eyesonthescreen.org and find out what they're talking about and get busy. February 8th at 8 p.m. across the country, there'll be screenings in a lot of places, and it'll be a great opportunity for those of us who want to honor Black History Month to get busy. Thanks again, Tiffany Chang.
Thank you.
All right, moving on to our next story. We have Mark Parziel in studio, and Mark built his truck to run on vegetable oil. And I met Mark last week, and I was just I was blown away by the whole idea. And I've heard of biodiesel, and I know about people making their own fuel and, you know, spending about a week to make this fuel. But then there's vegetable oil, and you can actually convert your diesel engine to run on vegetable oil. And Mark has a website that I want to give out right now, and then we'll go into a discussion with Mark about the details. It's greasenotgas.com.
Woo!
greasenotgas.com. I believe there might have been some sort of inspiration related to Food Not Bombs, but we'll ask about that. So, Mark, welcome to Indie Media on Air on KPFK.
Thanks for having me. It's Mike, by the way. Mike.
Oh, did I say Mark?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No problem.
So why don't we talk about how you got into building a truck to run on vegetable oil?
I guess originally I just wanted to save money and started looking around for alternative fuels, and came across vegetable oil, and the environmental issues is what really got me excited about it, and it did turn out to be a free fuel source, just using waste from restaurants. And that was 3 years ago, and I've been just driving around on vegetable oil ever since.
So tell us about the process. How do you go about converting an engine? I think in the and this story to me is just so amazing, because in the context of wars in the Middle East, wars that are no doubt linked to oil and the control of oil in this entire economy, and in the context of global warming and a massive environmental crisis, I think this is a great example of a do-it-yourself DIY initiative to, stop being reliant on fossil fuels. So, tell us about how you go about doing this. How do you build an engine to run on vegetable oil?
Well, basically, the reason it works really well is because the diesel engine was originally designed to run on vegetable oil by Rudolf Diesel, and so when you do switch it to vegetable oil, nothing changes. We just finished a van yesterday, and we were driving around. My friend was surprised at saying that, you know, the engine doesn't even flinch. Nothing changes. So at first, when you are successful with it, you think that you're not, because nothing changes. But it works really well. And essentially, the only thing you have to do with the grease is heat it before it gets to the injectors. And just the fact that your coolant or antifreeze is running through the engine at 212 degrees or somewhere around there, it's perfect to be able to heat the grease with that. So basically, you once you do have a diesel vehicle, you'll want to get two tanks, and one of the tanks is for diesel. Start up on diesel, drive around till your coolant gets hot enough, and that coolant in turn heats the vegetable oil by either wrapping around the fuel tank or actually going through it. And then once that's taken place, you have a switch on your dashboard, switch it over to vegetable oil, and you just keep going.
And there you go.
Yeah.
So it's what are the pieces involved? You got a couple of tanks, you got some hoses, you got a filter, but everything that's on the engine itself is the same, right? It's all stock.
Yeah.
Before the fuel injection.
Yeah. Actually, the whole conversion process takes place before the lift pump, which is the first thing the fuel is going to come into meet on its way to the engine. And so you're really not doing a conversion on the engine per se, but mostly the fuel delivery system. And I guess the real integral part is that you're splicing into the coolant lines and you're running those to the fuel tank. And it works really easily with a tank, with a vehicle that has two tanks, like a full-size pickup, which is what I run. And that's easy for me to just drop a tank out and heat that one. But in a smaller, maybe a Volkswagen Jetta or something, you only have one fuel tank to begin with, so you actually have to weld one or find one that'll fit in the trunk or something like that. So it's a little more problem solving involved.
How much money do you think it costs to put all these pieces together?
The van we just finished, it just took us 2 days to do it, and when we finished up yesterday, we kind of added it all up, and it was about $500, maybe $600. And the main cost is the vegetable oil fuel filter. It's about $150, maybe $200. And it's a wire mesh filter that when the vegetable oil goes through it, any little particles get stuck in the steel screen. And it's a filter that you can take apart, and you take out the steel screen and you rinse it out with some degreaser or some brake cleaner or whatever, and you put it back together. And that's really important because that filter, you wouldn't have to want to replace it every maybe 500-600 miles. Depends on how well how clean the grease is that you get from the restaurant, but you can go, over 1,000 miles without having to clean that thing.
Well, let's talk about that. Where do you get this grease?
Originally when I first got into it, I didn't really have a reference for what was clean grease and what was dirty grease, so I just went around and kind of took whatever, but I learned the hard way what clean grease is. And it turns out that most Asian cuisine yields the cleanest grease. And I think it's just because they're in the habit of changing their grease more frequently. Whereas a lot of people say, oh, you just pull up to McDonald's and take their grease. But it doesn't quite work because their grease is really dirty.
So not only is their food pretty much poison from the grease, you
can't even run a damn car on it.
Yeah, it's I guess.
Why is that?
Well, because they're trying to pinch every penny. So they use the grease as long as humanly possible. And it gets a lot of free fatty acids in it and a lot more particulate matter. So it's a liquid when it's in their fry later, but when they pour it into their grease trap out back and it cools, it'll congeal to the point where it's almost a solid. So as you can imagine, it's not easy to collect. Whereas from a sushi restaurant, the grease is going to remain liquid all the time. It's really clean. It looks like honey. And you just drop a sump pump into it, which is powered by your vehicle off of the battery, and you pump that liquid grease into your vehicle, just filtering on the way in.
Right on. So you're from Oregon, is that right, originally? Or
Originally I'm from Boston. Okay. And I've lived in Oregon for the past 4 years, and I left there 3 months ago and been just driving.
And just you've been going across the country on vegetable oil?
Yeah, in the past 3 years I drove across the whole country 6 times on vegetable oil. And the first time was I really wanted to just try it out. I didn't know much about it, so I just figured it'd be an adventure. And I did probably burn vegetable oil only 30% of the time. It was a real, it was in the winter and I had a real hard time with it. But then on the way back, I burned probably 50% of the time. And then the next trip, 70% of the time. And once I kind of got the system down, it's easy to do 100% of the time pretty much now. But the whole greasenotgas.com, that project is based on the idea that all that learning curve, troubleshooting can kind of be avoided. And I want to be able to I'm just making a DVD where someone can watch it, and by the time they're finished watching it, they can be confident that they can go out and do it, and they know what the pitfalls are and how to avoid them and, you know, make it work for themselves.
So let's talk about supply for a second. I mean, I imagine a whole lot of people get busy with your DVD and start to convert their cars for $500, $600. You know, that's probably, what, 15, 20 tanks of gas these days, maybe 15 tanks of gas. How inexhaustible a supply do you think is out there? How many people could be doing this?
Well, actually, the, like, long-term goal is to lean more towards biodiesel. But the as far as the waste vegetable oil that's available in the United States, the last figure, I think, for last year was 4 billion gallons a year of waste vegetable. So there's a lot out there. But it is, some of it's really, you know, McDonald's grease that you can't use.
Do you have a statistic on how much normal, you know, gas people use a year in this country?
I don't. I'll probably put that on the website, but at this point, I'm not sure. But
be a pretty cool compare. I mean, I'm just thinking out loud.
Yeah,
you know,
it's like probably like a 1%.
Well, maybe not. You know, but I guess I'm just listening to this, and you know, in the world of DIY transportation, like Chris was saying at the top of this interview. It's just crazy, the downward spiral we're on around oil, and this kind of initiative is so wild. How fast do you go? How fast can your car go? Can you rev it up?
Definitely. It well, because of the, you know, the fact that it was, the diesel was originally designed to run on vegetable oil, that's why it works so well. And so you do get like a 15 and 20% horsepower boost when you're running on vegetable oil. And if you're, say you're driving in the Midwest up like a steady incline and you're, I'm in a, you know, a 1984 pickup truck, I can't go too fast. If I'm going 55 on diesel, I hit the switch on the dash and switch it to vegetable oil. About 8 seconds later, once that vegetable oil gets the injectors, it'll speed up to 70. And then if I switch it back to diesel just to experiment, it'll slow back down to 55.
Wow.
And the reason it works really well is because of the lubricity of the fuel. So it lubricates the pumps really well. And it cleans carbon deposits off the injectors. It burns more completely.
And the residual environmental impact. What are you releasing into the atmosphere?
Well, as far as like the reduction, sometimes if you're looking around on the web, you will find a lot of different varying statistics on what the actual reduction is for emissions. But sometimes it'll say 100% on carbon dioxide. And what people are referring to there is a closed carbon cycle, and what they mean is that it's an organic-based fuel, so that through photosynthesis, plants are sequestering carbon dioxide out of the environment, and when you release it, you're just, you know, it's going back into the plants that are pulling it out of the environment to create it. So it's just a big loop. And then sulfur dioxide, which is, you know, what causes acid rain, that's 100% reduced. And like soot and things like particulate matter that's in the emissions is reduced a lot. I went through emissions in Boston, and I had to send my results to Oregon, and the guy that tested it was just blown away. He'd never seen a vegetable powered diesel before, and it was like he said, the best result he ever got on the test was a mark of 15, and when I went through, it was 0.5.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You started the truck up for me outside before the show, and it smelled like a fast food restaurant coming out of the exhaust.
Yeah. Because of whatever's burned in the fryolator to begin with, you know, it'll smell like that in the exhaust. So if you do get grease from like a donut shop, it'll smell like donuts. And but for the most,
Krispy Kreme truck is going by, right?
Actually, I went to Krispy Kreme once and asked for their grease, and they said, "Oh, we don't dispose of any grease." And I said, "Well, where does it go?" And they said, "It just absorbs into the donuts,
into our customers' bodies."
we're going to have to take a break here, and we want to come back and get people to call in and have a discussion about vegetable oil. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara and on the internet at kpfk.org. Stay tuned. Welcome to back to Indie Media on Air. This is KPFK, and we are in studio with Mike Parziel, who has a website called GreaseNotGas.com and explains how to convert your diesel engine to run on vegetable oil. Why don't we explain what biodiesel is and what the difference is between the two?
Okay. Yeah, I mentioned earlier the kind of the long-term goal of the project is to lean more towards biodiesel, which is biodiesel is just vegetable oil that's had the glycerin taken out of it. And so in regards to Steve's question about the availability of waste vegetable oil, you know, if there was a point where it was too popular and there was not enough waste, the farmers in the Midwest can kick up their soy production and create more biodiesel, which really should be the way to go. It's more of a mainstream, you know, easier route. It's the infrastructure already exists because it can go right into the fuel pumps that are, you know, on the side of the street. Right. And so biodiesel, it's the only problems that are, you know, exist with it is that it's a solvent-based fuel, so it will deteriorate rubber components over time, but a lot of people just assume their fuel lines are rubber, but actually they're mostly composites after 1995, and they're like Teflon or Viton, something that can actually take biodiesel. And but anyhow, I guess the main goal is to just reach out to like a U.S. renewable resource for fuel.
So if people want to find out more about biodiesel and the kind of, you know, the vegetable oil-based version and the glycerin extracted version, they can go to your website?
Yeah, at this point, the website's mostly just talking about what our goals are for the DVD. It doesn't talk too much about biodiesel, but we have to put up a links page, and we're actually rebuilding the site right now. But I think if you look around on the website, most people who have never heard of biodiesel, which is kind of, you know, average American doesn't know what it is, when you first come across it and you look around, I think people are generally surprised by how much information there is on it, just because they wonder why they haven't heard of it before.
What's that address again?
My address is greasenotgas.com, just all one word.
You've told me a couple stories about running into restaurants, and I thought they were really funny. So what's it like going into a restaurant and asking for grease?
It's usually a pretty interesting experience because, there is the few and far between chance where the restaurant owner knows what you're talking about. And they say, oh, yeah, we had somebody who used to do that a year or two ago or whatever. But for the most part, because you're looking at sushi restaurants and Chinese food, you'll go in and want to talk to a manager. And sometimes there's a language barrier, and you're trying to tell them that you want to take the grease to put in your truck, and it's really kind of a confusing time. So I actually learned a little Japanese in order to get by that at some points where I just want to be able to tell them basically what's going on. But for the most part, they pay to get rid of it, and so when they realize that you're doing them a favor, their only concern turns into like, okay, just don't make a mess. And, yeah. But then they'll generally come outside, and I'll leave the truck running so they can smell the exhaust. That's usually the clincher because they don't normally believe it until they smell it, and they'll come outside, and then they'll be really excited.
We have some callers on the line. We want to take some questions and start off with Joe in San Fernando.
Yeah, hey, how's it going?
Welcome to KPFK. Do you have a question?
Yeah, good show here. Something practical we can do to help out our planet, you know, and stick it to the big corporations, the energy giants. But anyway, my question is regarding are you talking about, you say it's a two-step process to get the grease warmed up first, and the first step is another fuel source. I'm wondering, is that petroleum-based, and if so, is it possible to use some form of biodiesel, which is plant-based, to totally run it petro-free, you know, to burn that type of fuel? And then another question is, do you need to process the grease? And then last question is, is there a difference between animal and plant-based grease that you get from restaurants?
Thanks for your question, Joe.
Yeah, as far as the first question about biodiesel, if you're in an area where you can find biodiesel from a distributor, you can totally put that into your startup tank. You can start up on biodiesel till the coolant's warm. But being that generally I'm driving around just kind of the whole country in places where I'm not sure. We'll have to get diesel here and there, like, but if it's a successful drive, it's pretty seldom. And then I would definitely encourage biodiesel for startup. And then the other question about processing the vegetable oil is really all you have to do is filter it. And there's special filters that you can get from, they're made for water, but if you get the right micron rating and the right, if it's made from polyethylene, then you can heat the grease as it goes through the filter. It'll go right through, and that's something that you want to do. That's called pre-filter. You do that before it goes into the tank, and then that way the filter that's, you know, on the way to the motor, it won't clog as frequently.
What about the animal fat in the grease versus vegetable or grease that's been used without?
I think as far as I don't know much about as far as like chemical composition, but I know once it's heated up, if you can get it to go through that filter, it'll burn just fine in the motor. As far and also any organic oil, sunflower seed oil or peanut oil or anything.
Okay, our next caller is Donna in Los Angeles. Welcome to KPFK.
Donna, welcome to KPFK.
Donna, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. What's your question? Question or comment for Mike?
I have a 76 Volkswagen bus. Is there any way it can be converted to diesel?
Yeah, it's usually more work than it's worth. Really?
Oh, but I love this bus.
Yeah.
I've had it a long time.
Yeah, if you don't mind investing a little, you can find a diesel motor that that fits up with the motor mounts on that vehicle. And there's some kits for if the transmission doesn't meet up to the flywheel where, you could have a mechanic put one in there.
Right.
It's not really – I actually swapped out a motor in my truck and was surprised at how little work it was, because really you just disconnect everything and then reconnect everything.
So a good mechanic could do that.
Yeah, it's possible. I think the important thing to do would be look around through like wrecking yards and try to find a place that sells that, particular motor you're looking for. But as far as Volkswagen, I know that, TDIs are the most popular for their diesels. I don't know if they make anything else, but I know after, I think they kind of got popular in the United States around 84, and the newer ones, they just came out with a V10, which would probably power your bus pretty well, but it's probably really expensive to get it brand new.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's kind of worth it to me. $20,000 for a new car is such a waste of money.
Yeah. You could get a crate motor from Volkswagen and you look under the, that Volkswagen Touareg, their SUV that comes in a TDI V10, that motor is probably one of the best diesel motors going right now.
Also, you make a whole lot of friends at the local sushi restaurants, too.
I live around a lot of sushi restaurants. Does your car ever smell like fish, though?
No. If there's a seafood restaurant, I'll generally pass by. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, for the most part, like sports pubs and things like that, just kind of all-American food is generally far too dirty to take the grease. So just keep your eye out for sort of Thai food or sushi or just Chinese food in general.
Oh, it sounds so great. Thanks.
Thanks for calling, Donna. Our next caller is Don in Los Angeles. Welcome to KPFK.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I was wondering if you guys had seen this study that was done by some academics about how to produce biodiesel on a mass scale to where you could completely replace fossil fuels in the U.S.?
Yeah, actually, I did read about a study done where they were making biodiesel from pond scum? No.
Yeah, some kind of bacteria.
Yeah, from algae or something. Something that...
Yeah, some genetically engineered microorganism.
Yeah, and I think they found that it would have been really easy, I think the plant matter, like by volume, was 50% oil. So once they pressed the oil out of it, it yielded a ton. And this was a few years ago. I just read about the study saying, okay, yeah, we can do it. I think the United States government actually funded the study, but then once they came to the conclusion that they could do it, they just decided not to.
Boy, that's familiar, huh?
Well, there's one big problem with that. Like, if you think about it, if you had, like they were saying in the study, these, millions of acres of, like, the deserts with these ponds in them, right? And it had, you were using some microorganisms to produce the oil, right? Then if you got into war with somebody, they could just send out some, special bug that's going to kill those things and, like, wipe out your fuel production, So, like, strategically there'd be, like, an issue with doing things like that. But the other issue with growing soybeans or hemp or something like that for the fuel source is that with the current, agricultural system, it's like they put so much oil into growing the plants that it's like, you know, who knows? You might be using more oil to grow the plants than you would be using if you were just putting it in the car.
Not to mention the water resources that go into that kind of agriculture.
Word.
All right, let's move on. Let's take another caller. Thanks for your call. Next up is Wes in Simi Valley. Welcome to KPFK.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if you get better mileage with the vegetable oil.
Yeah, you do. In my truck, I just started measuring that recently. And the past maybe 10,000 miles, I've been getting consistent reading of about 15 miles per gallon on diesel, and I'll get between 18 and 20 on vegetable oil.
Excellent. And I noticed you said you did a conversion recently of a car, and it cost $500 to $600. Do you have a shop somewhere?
No, we just did it in our friend's driveway. It's generally like, you know, maybe a day or two of work, depending on, I guess actually the hardest part that we had a problem with is sourcing out the parts. And there are companies that they put together a kit. You tell them what vehicle that you have, and they'll make you a special kit. It's going to be more expensive, but it can be, you know, less of a headache. And the one that I've dealt with and had the best luck with is Greasel, greasel.com. And there's a whole team of people there that are putting together kits constantly.
And finally, have you heard of the use of jojoba bean oil for the internal viscosity of the engine?
No, I haven't actually. We were just talking about that yesterday as far as motor oil. But no, I don't know anything about that.
I would check into it. It has a very high viscosity. I think it would work really well.
Oh, cool.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call. What, and the website?
The website for the kits is Greasel. It's just greasel.com. And there's a whole lot of information on there. They're a pretty good website.
Okay, great. Our next caller is Bill in Pasadena. Welcome to KPFK, Bill.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and an attaboy to Mike for his efforts.
Thanks.
Previous caller, Wes, really answered my direct question about efficiencies and ranges. I guess more specifically, then, I'd like to add perhaps a conversation regarding gray water collection systems, but I guess today's topic being an alternative to the questions about hydrogen fuel as an alternative. Just thanks for your efforts. I guess my question was answered directly.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Next up is John in Los Alamitos. John, welcome to KPFK.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Just curious if you have any information regarding, I assume this would work with on large tractor-trailer rigs?
Yeah, actually, as far as the question before about, you know, using more oil to, you know, to create the fuel through soybeans or whatever it may be, as far as semis, that's kind of that's the biggest market for biodiesel because they use so much fuel. And so biodiesel has been, you know, more popular with the semis, and most truck drivers kind of seem to know a little bit more about it than just the average American. And as far as the straight vegetable oil conversion, I don't know anybody that's converted a whole semi. I know of school buses and stuff, but I'm sure it's possible. It's just a matter of probably finding a larger fuel filter and making sure that the whole entire tank is heated really well.
Is it basically, I guess you'd find the parts the same source that you get for the automobiles?
Yeah. Usually the hardest part is that cleanable filter, which is kind of a key component. It's made by a company called Raycor, and they do make all kinds of different sizes. I know they make one that's quite a bit larger than the one we're using on the vehicle we just did was a 7.3, it was a Ford Powerstroke. So it's using a lot of fuel, but they do make a larger filter. I imagine it would work on a semi.
And one other quick one, when the motor's off, I mean, doesn't that stuff solidify a bit? So do you have a problem with a situation like that?
Yeah, actually, I guess I haven't mentioned that yet.
And I came in a little late, so I don't know if I missed
actually, that. You know, that's good that you brought that up because we haven't really covered that. But basically what happens is when you get to where you're going, you know, a mile or two before, you just switch it back to the diesel or the biodiesel tank, whichever you're running in there. And it'll flush out that vegetable oil, and then when you go to start up, you can start right up on diesel or biodiesel. But sometimes if I'm getting directions somewhere and, I get there, you know, before I hit the switch, I'll just park it, let it idle for a little bit and switch it to diesel and then, you know, go inside to wherever I'm going and then come back out. And you can smell, you know, if you're going to leave it overnight, you got to shut it off. But around, you know, a, say, 60-degree climate, you can leave it for 3 or 4 hours on vegetable oil. It'll start right up.
Great. Thanks for the info.
Thanks for your call, John.
Thank you.
We're going to go to one more call. But before we do that, I want to ask you about the suspension issue. With that much extra weight in vegetable oil, is it going to be a problem?
No, because for the most part, if you've got a smaller vehicle, you don't have a humongous tank, you're not sucking down a ton of fuel. But in my truck, it's a full-size pickup, so when I want to go for a long drive, I'll fill up, you know, as much as possible just for the convenience factor, not have to stop. And it does add some weight to it, but having a half-ton pickup and adding, I don't know, maybe I think 120 gallons is probably the most I've ever put back there. It's never been an issue, but I did have a camper on the back that I used to live in, and that was too heavy for my truck. After, like, driving around for a year, blew up my wheel bearings.
What's the farthest you've gone without stopping?
The farthest I've gone was I filled up those three tanks in Boulder, Colorado, and I made it all the way to New Jersey without stopping. But when I say not stopping, I mean I didn't drive straight. I just I didn't have to stop to collect grease or anything. It's all – I have the system set up so that it's controlled by just switches in the cab. So when you notice your fuel level's low, you just hit the switch and fill it up while you're driving, which is kind of fun.
Okay. Tom in Long Beach, welcome to KPFK. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes. From a practical standpoint, if you converted your car, you say you go to sushi bars to get the grease, and say you have an average 9-to-5 job where you're driving 25 miles to 50 miles a day, how often do you end up, you know, tracking down a sushi bar to get the grease? I mean, is this something that you do once a month, or do you end up doing it the same number of times that you go to fill up your gas tank regularly?
Yeah.
Or
yeah, generally you're going to go just a little bit less than you would for filling up your gas tank just because of the fact that you're getting a little bit better gas mileage. But for the most part, it's going to be about the same fuel consumption. You probably won't notice. But the thing to do is if you do, you know, find a restaurant in your area that has clean grease, set up a relationship with the manager where you could go there at night and just with your sump pump, just pump out the grease. And it's usually just a 55-gallon drum that's next to the dumpster, so it's not the kind of thing where it's locked away or anything. If you get permission, then you're pretty much good to go.
And can you maybe get a quantity so you don't have to go back each tank full, or are you pretty much limited for some reason to going back to the sushi bar each time?
You could take as much as, I mean, if you made a container where you could take more than, say you had a 20-gallon fuel tank and you were able to take 40 gallons, then obviously you're going to be able to go further. But I think one thing to keep in mind is if you do get to the inconvenience factor where you just can't find the time to stop, you can always burn biodiesel or just get diesel at the pump if you have to, if you're out of your neighborhood or whatever, you can't find it.
Great.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
We're sitting in the studio on Indy Media On Air with Mike Parziel, who has built a truck which is sitting in the KPFK lot right now that runs on vegetable oil. He has a website called greasenotgas.com.
That comes from Food Not Bombs inspiration, yeah?
Yeah. One of my friends that I converted his vehicle and we were working together on it was he's a guy who used to be a professional snowboarder and just kind of got out of it, thought snowboarding was lame, and started to donate all his money from snowboarding to Food Not Bombs. So we had a bit of a relationship set up with them, and we just took that name, and we kind of want to take steps to work a little bit more with them in the future.
Great.
So really appreciate you making the time and having you down here. Hope some of our listeners have been inspired to transform their vehicles. If you want to find out more, go to greasenotgas.com or greasel.com, which is greasel.com. Is that right?
G-R-E-A-S. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for coming in, and we're really happy to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Mike.
And we're going to jump right now to our promised update on the World Social Forum. We have on the line with us Anna Noguera, who is a producer with Democracy Now and a longtime member of the New York City Indie Media Collective. She's just returned to New York City from the World Social Forum, which was taking place this past week in Porto Alegre, Brazil. Welcome, Anna.
Hi, how you doing? Good to be on air again.
Great to have you.
Hi, Anna. How are you doing? It's Chris.
Hi, Chris.
What was it like down there?
Well, it was absolutely amazing. There were, by organizer standards, or estimates, 120,000 people there in Porto Alegre. It's the fourth time the World Social Forum has been held in Porto Alegre. Last year it was in Mumbai. And it was the largest number of people ever at the World Social Forum. 40,000 of those, I should say, were at the youth camp. There was an unprecedented number of youth from mostly South America, many of the Latin American countries, gathering together and holding their own mini World Social Forum there as well, with their own tents and their own workshops on everything from, you know, how to make a garden to how to make a biodiesel engine as well. An amazing group of people.
So you sound really lifted up, Anna. It sounds like you were inspired by what you saw. Quick question for you on the kind of tone and tenor of the analysis that was running down there. Was the emphasis on anti-imperialism, or is it still focused on the spread of neoliberalism, or are the two being conjoined? What was your takeaway there?
I was expecting it to be very focused on the war in Iraq and what to do now that Bush has been elected, possibly for the first time. But it wasn't. The people remained focused on issues of globalization and sustainability. You know, the environment was a very huge issue. Climate change, Greenpeace, I spoke to a lot of Greenpeace people, and they really want to make climate change the biggest issue, you know, of 2005 and beyond, especially for U.S. audience. You know, they think that the United States is severely misinformed about global warming, and people really need to get on the boat now to prevent, you know, what could happen. So, no, it wasn't just the war. Imperialism was a mega issue, though, and it seemed to unite all the issues together. But the organizers also realized this, and so they very efficiently broke up the forum, as in contrast to past years where they had morning plenaries that cover very broad issues and only a few people got to speak to an audience of 1,000 or so. This year they broke up all the issues into 11 themes and set up these mega tents that span probably about 2 miles or so, and, you know, dozens of tents. And that allowed activists to really focus on issues and zone in on you know, 11, one of 11 themes or two of 11 themes and really network with the people who are working on similar issues. War and demilitarization was a mega issue, and it was very closely tied to economic globalization because the analysis is that the two go hand in hand these days.
Anna, what was the focus of the youth forums, and was there a different vision between the youth forums and the other aspects of the World Social Forum?
Yeah, well, the youth forum was very diverse. I mean, there were people there who had been to every single World Social Forum and, you know, participated in the forum itself and also tried to bring some of the issues into the youth camp and have smaller conversations with the younger generation. There was also a lot of people there who I think didn't even go to the forum at all. They, you know, they're there just to meet other people from Latin America and have a good time. So there is a lot of a party scene, too. There was one group in particular that I know called the Caracol Intergaláctica, and it's actually a network of many activists who've been in the anti-globalization movement for years, coming together and holding workshops of their own. And there, you know, the thinking there is that there's a little bit of disappointment in the forum in that they feel like it's been taken over a little bit by by ULA or other governments. You know, ministers are coming from all over the world as well as activists, as well as corporations. There are, I don't know how many corporations actually sponsor the forum. So there's a lot of criticism from the youth camp of the forum in that regard. And it's interesting, you know, it's been in Porto Alegre for 4 years. It's become sort of entrenched there. It's almost like a market that's targeted to the activists. You know, there's little booths set up all over the place selling Che Guevara T-shirts and all that. So it's going to move next year. I think next year the plan is that it's going to decentralize even more, which I think is very positive. There's talk of one being held in Venezuela, a Latin American forum being held in Venezuela, an African-European forum being held in
Morocco possibly, and then possibly even the U.S. forum, which I think would be very positive, you know, to bring that kind of attention to U.S. citizens. And then in 2007, they're talking about having it in South Africa. I think the more it moves around, the better, to give, you know, more people a chance to participate. Here also, there was very, you know, compared to last few years, it was many more Brazilians came than in past years, and fewer international activists. So I think the more it moves around, the better.
Anna, listen, we really appreciate your filing that report, and we know that for those who want to find out more, Democracy Now! Will be doing significant coverage with Anna, and also they'll be at nyc.indymedia.org. Just a quick thanks across the board here. We have Chris Burnett in the studio. We have engineer Maggie LaPique. We have producer Alan Minsky. Thanking our guests, Tiffany Chang from Downhill Battle, Mike from Grease Not Gas, and, of course, Anna Nagora from New York.
GreaseNotGas.com.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being with you today, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Indie Media On Air, heard Mondays from 3 to 4 in the afternoon. This is community-based KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and at kpfk.org for the world. The Voices from the Frontline edition of the 4 o'clock report is coming up next with Eric Mann. Stay tuned.